This is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to the October 28th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. The land of Afghanistan and the peoples who have lived there have seen many would-be conquerors come and go over the centuries, but their present-day problems may be said to stem from the last years of Jimmy Carter's administration. That's when his national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, proposed that the United States provide arms to the Mujahideen that were seeking to overthrow the government in Kabul that was allied with the Soviet Union. As Brzezinski recalled in a January 1998 interview published in the French magazine Le Nouvel Observateur, quote, "It was July 3, 1979, that President Carter signed the first directive for secret aid to the opponents of the pro-Soviet regime in Kabul. And that very day," said Brzezinski, "I wrote a note to the president in which I explained to him that, in my opinion, this aid was going to induce a Soviet military intervention." "Despite this risk," his interviewer asked, "you were an advocate of this covert action, but perhaps you yourself desired this Soviet entry into war and looked to provoke it." "It isn't quite that," Zbigniew replied. "We didn't push the Russians to intervene, but we knowingly increased the probability that they would." To this, the interviewer countered, "When the Soviets justify their intervention by asserting that they intended to fight against a secret involvement of the United States in Afghanistan, people didn't believe them. However, there was a basis of truth." "You don't regret anything today?" "Regret what?" replied Brzezinski. "That secret operation was an excellent idea. It had the effect of drawing the Russians into the Afghan trap, and you want me to regret it?" "The day that the Soviets officially crossed the border, I wrote to President Carter, we now have the opportunity of giving to the USSR its Vietnam War." "Indeed, for almost 10 years, Zbigniew went on, "Moscow had to carry on a war unsupportable by the government, a conflict that brought about the demoralization and finally the breakup of the Soviet Empire." To which the interviewer then asked, "And neither do you regret having supported this Islamic fundamentalism, having given arms and advice to future terrorists?" "What is the most important to the history of the world?" Brzezinski confidently responded. "The Taliban or the collapse of the Soviet Empire? Some stirred-up Muslims or the liberation of Central Europe and the end of the Cold War?" Again, that was from an interview with former National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski, published in Le Nouvel Observateur in Paris in January 1998. Brzezinski was a foreign policy advisor to President Obama before he was elected to office. It's something to think about when considering Obama's recent decision to reverse his earlier commitment to withdraw the remaining U.S. troops and end 15 years of America's engagement in Afghanistan. He did so in the wake of the Taliban's capture of the Afghan city of Kunduz and the abject failure of the U.S.-trained Afghan army to stop them. Though the U.S. press did not mention it, it is likely that the Taliban victory raised a specter in Obama's mind and in that of his military advisors of what happened in South Vietnam following the withdrawal of U.S. troops 4 decades ago, a humiliating spectacle that no one in Washington wanted to see repeated. This probably weighed upon the president as much as what has occurred in Iraq since he fulfilled President George W. Bush's promise and pulled U.S. troops from that battleground. That only occurred because Iraq's President Maliki refused to grant U.S. servicemen immunity from crimes committed against Iraqi civilians, a waiver that Washington demands from all the more than 130 countries where U.S. troops are stationed. At 20 minutes past the hour, I hope to be discussing the implication of President Obama's decision to maintain U.S. troops in Afghanistan with Junaid Ahmed, the director of the Center for Global Dialogue in Lahore, Pakistan, and professor of law and politics at the University of Lahore. I will also be getting his thoughts concerning the 7.5 earthquake that was centered deep in northern Afghanistan's inaccessible mountain range on Monday, which has caused extensive damage across the entire area as well as in Pakistan and India. In contrast to the 7.5 earthquake, the Taliban has encouraged aid groups to help victims in northern Afghanistan and Pakistan as rescuers try to gauge the extent of the damage as the death toll continues to rise. The unstable security situation poses a major threat to the international aid groups that have been targeted by the Taliban in the past, but this time the Taliban has ordered its fighters to help the victims. We'll see if that happens. While speaking of Afghanistan and what appears to be an effort to counter the grisly images that have emerged on the internet from the deliberate and prolonged attack by U.S. fighter jets on the Doctors Without Borders hospital in Kunduz last month, U.S. media, including NPR, is citing reports from the 8-year-old Syrian American Medical Society that the Russian Air Force has routinely bombed hospitals and medical facilities in Syria, causing yet more Syrians to flee their homeland. Nothing they have reported, however, compares with U.S. bombing of the hospital in Kunduz, whose location was known by the Air Force and whose pleas to halt the murderous attack while it was happening were ignored. The total number of dead is known to be at least 30, including 10 known patients, 13 known staff, and 7 unrecognizable bodies that were in the wreck of the hospital that have since been buried, although they were never identified. Beyond the immediate death toll, the destruction of Medicine Sans Frontières' 94-bed trauma center will have a huge impact on access to surgical care for hundreds of thousands of people, since it was the only facility of its kind in northeastern Afghanistan. Doctors Without Borders has called it a war crime and for an international investigation. President Obama, who waited 5 days before offering an apology, has turned to General John F. Campbell, the American commander in Afghanistan, who appointed Major General William Hickman, who was not part of the unit that conducted the bombing, to supervise a separate investigation of the attack. Whether the escalation of the attacks by Palestinians on Israelis and Israelis on Palestinians is leading to a third intifada, the escalation of the rhetoric on the Israeli side has reached new lows. Nothing has caused more controversy or discomfort on the part of Israel's supporters than the declaration by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that Hitler had no intention to kill Europe's Jews, only expel them, and that he committed the Third Reich to exterminating European Jewry only on the urging of the Grand Mufti, Haji Amin al-Husseini. The Mufti was a religious leader of Palestinian Sunni Muslims in the 30s and spent the Second World War in Nazi Germany. He was, without question, an avid supporter of Hitler and the Nazis and openly against Jews who he saw as taking over Palestine. But as those who have criticized Netanyahu have pointed out, there is no evidence that he influenced Hitler's final dissolution. In France, Germany, and Austria, and one or two other European countries, Netanyahu's exoneration of Hitler would be considered a form of Holocaust denial and subject whoever uttered or wrote it to a fine or imprisonment, possibly both. In the right-wing commentary magazine, editor Jonathan Tobin, a longtime supporter of Netanyahu, wrote, quote, "The worst part of this was that many people interpreted Netanyahu's statement as somehow absolving Hitler of responsibility for the Holocaust. This led some historians to denounce him as conducting a defense of Hitler, calling him a Holocaust revisionist and even a Holocaust denier, as one Hebrew University professor told the New York Times. That some of those using these terms as political enemies doesn't diminish the damage this incident has done to Netanyahu," Tobin continued. "At a time when anti-Semites and other enemies of Israel are doing their best to delegitimize Israel's government and libeling the Jews as the new Nazis," wrote Tobin, "this wasn't what the Jewish state needed," end quote. What the American public needs is the truth, and is generally hard to find on the mainstream media. While it trumpets that Palestinians are upset over what they believe is a planned takeover of the Al-Aqsa Mosque in East Jerusalem, the story is far more complex and reveals that Israel is continuing the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians that began in 1948 and has no intent in letting the Palestinians control any of the land between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean. Take the Palestinians' position in the old city of Jerusalem. In the October 23rd issue of the Jewish Weekly Forward, Naomi Zeveloff, writing from Jerusalem, writes, quote, "Since Israel's seizure of the West Bank and East Jerusalem in the 1967 Six-Day War, Israeli settler groups have been subsidizing Jews to move into the old city's Muslim quarter in order to erode Palestinian claims to the area. The most active organization is Atri Kohanim, the Crown of the Priests. The group says that it is bringing Jews back to the Muslim quarter where many Jews used to live until 1929 when Palestinian riots against their presence drove them out. Then as now," Zeveloff writes, "Muslim fears of a Jewish takeover of the Al-Aqsa Mosque help fuel the violence. Yet unlike Palestinians who want to return to homes they've fled or are forced from by Jews in Israel sounding war, Atzvet Kohanim has the backing of the state in its project. With help over the years from the Israeli government and support from American donors abroad, Atzvet Kohanim has acquired rights in many government-seized or controlled properties in East Jerusalem, often without public tender and well below market prices. Zevalov writes, a 1992 Justice Ministry report found that the government confiscated some of the Palestinian properties on the basis of unsupported affidavits submitted by Atzvet Kohanim about their absentee owner status. The government then transferred rights to the properties exclusively to Atzvet Kohanim at preferred prices. While most of the Atzvet Kohanim properties were acquired from the government, it also buys out Arab tenants or secures the eviction of those who fail to cooperate, replacing them with national religious Jewish settlers, most of them, I should add, not born in Israel, many from the United States. Anyway, she goes on, as Jews moved into the Muslim quarter, Israeli police came to protect them. Now they are in even greater numbers. The massive police presence has made the street look like the military occupation Israel long denied it was maintaining in East Jerusalem. End quote. Naomi Zevaloff writing in the Jewish Weekly Forward. Well, anyway, this is the unbridled face of Israeli racism, and the only thing left out of this article is that the donations by American Jews to Atzvet Kohanim that amount to over $2 million each year are tax-deductible on the pretense that it is an educational organization. The message on its U.S. funding arm, Friends of Atzvet Kohanim, closes with this statement, the meaning of which is unmistakable. Quote, Jerusalem belongs to every single Jew wherever he or she may live. We therefore call upon each and every one of you to pray for the safety and unity of Jerusalem and to support the rebuilding of Jewish life within a holy and eternal united Jerusalem, end quote. In other words, there's no place in Jerusalem for the Palestinians. As for the Palestinian leadership, even to call it that is a sick joke, since not only did Mahmoud Abbas's term as president expire in 2009, which the U.S. and the rest of the world conveniently ignore, he is by any definition of the word a collaborator with the Israeli government in maintaining the occupation and suppressing Palestinian resistance to it, which I've told you on previous editions of this program. This is all in accordance with the Oslo Agreement of 1993, which he negotiated and signed, that legitimized Israel's presence in the West Bank and promised the Palestinians nothing substantial in return, neither an end to Jewish settlements nor a Palestinian state. What is remarkable is that on Saturday, the New York Times carried a report of the collaboration between the Israeli and Palestinian security services, which the current spate of attacks between Israeli Jews and Palestinians puts in jeopardy. What's equally, if not more remarkable, is that both writers were Palestinian Arabs, Dia Hadid and Rami Nizal. The New York Times has a long history of assigning exclusively Jewish reporters to cover Israel and its conflict with the Palestinians, and it is important that this change, which will no doubt be temporary after the paper hears from its pro-Israel readers, be recognized. Here's some of what they wrote. Quote, the relatively low-key presence of Palestinian security forces at protests surging throughout the West Bank this month suggests a shift after years of close coordination with Israeli agencies. With the Palestinian leadership having announced that it will redefine the deeply unpopular security alliance in response to mounting public outrage over it, officers fear the demonstrators can turn the violent uprising aimed at Israel in their direction. Under agreements that began with the Oslo Peace Accords two decades ago, security coordination between the Palestinian Authority and the Israelis in the West Bank was largely credited with maintaining the calm that has been unraveling in recent weeks, as well as in quelling rivals to the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. And they go on. At its peak, the coordination between the two sides was tight and personal, with local officers meeting or calling one another five or more times a day, and senior commanders meeting every week or so, said Avi Isharoff, an Israeli reporter who focuses on Palestinian affairs. The two sides would share intelligence about suspected militants, and the Palestinians were notified of Israeli arrest raids in West Bank cities, ostensibly under full Palestinian control. Palestinian officers regularly assisted Israeli civilians who inadvertently wandered into these cities to return safely to Israeli-controlled territory 10 times this month alone, an Israeli military official said. But there were always strains. Palestinians chafed under rules that required Israeli approval of their weapons and ammunition, and the requirement that Palestinian officers and senior officials coordinate with Israeli forces to pass through areas under military control. Perhaps most visibly and most jarringly for many Palestinians, their security forces for years tried to block violent demonstrations at Israeli checkpoints or near Israeli settlements. In March, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, so-called, that's my comment, voted to suspend all security coordination with Israel, a step that was seen as largely symbolic. Now, with security coordination under increasing tension, PLO officials say they are studying how to scale back the arrangement or redefine it. There is a consensus that the status quo cannot continue, said one PLO official, who spoke on the condition of anonymity because he was not authorized to discuss the matter. But that does not mean the Palestinian Authority can just cancel the agreement outright, he added. Our security would not survive without coordination. We even have our bullets approved by them, he said, referring to the Israelis. The article in the New York Times continues. The spokesman for the Palestinian government, Ihab Besaiso, and the spokesman for Israel's military, Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner, declined to discuss the matter, and officials at Israel's Agency for Coordination with the Palestinians did not respond to repeated requests for interviews. A retired Israeli security official said the issue was too sensitive for him to comment on. But several Israeli and Palestinian experts said that coordination had been continuing throughout the crisis, if on a somewhat strained basis. A Palestinian prisoners' rights group, Adamir, has counted 800 Palestinians arrested by Israeli forces this month, including 500 in the West Bank, and raids most likely aided by coordination. Even with the scale-back presence, however, demonstrators remain wary of the security forces' intentions. Quote, those who show their faces get recorded. They take them later from their homes, Zayed, a 20-year-old student teacher, said while wrapping a sweater around his head to hide his face. Like most demonstrators interviewed, he provided only his first name, fearing he would be arrested later by the Palestinians. I cover my face in the authority and the army, Zayed added, referring to the Palestinian government and the Israeli military, but I'm more afraid of the authority, end quote. One Hamas activist, a 21-year-old student who also spoke on the condition of anonymity for fear of being seized by Palestinian forces, said October seemed like a stark contrast from September when he was caught in a detention sweep and interrogated along with 20 of his friends. He said, quote, situation on the street does not allow them to arrest anybody right now. People are too angry, they would turn on the forces, meaning the Palestinian collaborating forces. Well, that's from an article in Saturday's New York Times by Dia Hadid and Rami Nizal, two Palestinian writers. First time that issue has been covered by Palestinians and not Jews, Israeli or American.